The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
They're already talking about further unconventional approaches to stimulating inflation. Wouldn't it be ironic that we are, even as the Fed and other central bankers are doing everything that they can to create inflation, we're on the monetary cusp event which reshapes the way we look at money and banking for a generation or more, and they're actually trying to stoke it.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Sometimes the notes that we make to ourselves, okay, I know I write in my books, you write in your books, the notes that we make to ourselves sometimes become our best friends going forward. You know, it's called marginalia. And throughout history, if you can get the books of a thinker and then go look at what he was thinking when he was reading, you can actually tap into a greater diamond mine.
A good friend and mentor for both of us has been sending us books, and he's getting rid of a part of his economics library.
He's 92 years old. He's my free market mentor the last, 32 years.
It's like Christmas when the boxes arrive.
Yeah.
And when you open them, not only are the titles intriguing, but even more so, opening the book and seeing what Howard's thoughts were on this particular topic, seeing what was important and what were the action points from this particular conclusion. It's a sketch of a human life, but also wisdom distilled that we're the beneficiaries of.
You know, it reminds me, there's a obsession that mathematics had for about 300 years. It was called Fermat's Last Theorem, and it was finally solved back in the early 1990s, but men spent their entire lives trying to solve this. It basically just simply said Pythagorean's theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, doesn't work with any other exponent or any other power as it's raised. Yet mathematicians had a hard time proving it. But you know what's interesting, Dave? Where they found that theorem or that question was an amateur mathematician who did his work, like I said, over 300 years ago, a man named Fermat, and it became Fermat's Last Theorem. But it was in the marginalia of one of his math books. That's exactly right. Well, you were in New York last week, and you came home with a box of treasure.
Well, I did. I was at Grant's conference, and as it turns out, Jim Grant is moving offices from Wall Street down to the old Woolworth building, and they don't have as much library space.
Right.
So he had a huge table full of books, and I went through the titles, and some of the titles stood out to me as things that I just wouldn't ordinarily have, but I was interested in. The Manly Art of Bare-Knuckle Prize Fighting in America. It's not often that you come across that.
Yeah.
Or from 1924, The Agricultural Crisis, 1920 to 1923, dealing with the British agricultural crisis of that period. I mean, then there's a book from the 1950s, 1958, written by the chief economist, if you will, of West Germany.
Okay.
And kind of laying the course forward, Prosperity Through Competition by Ludwig Erhard. And a gentleman who I knew, David Darst, he was the person I did my training with at Morgan Stanley, who in the 80s wrote the Handbook of the Bond and Money Markets.
Right.
As a young man at that point. So fascinating for me, one last treasure was a book I already own by Bernard Lewis. Now, I'm interested in the Middle East. For us to look at and try to mitigate risk as it pertains to volatility, political or geopolitical volatility in the Middle East, means that a part of our process is to go back in time and understand who we're dealing with, what we're talking about in more concrete terms.
Well, and he was in his 90s when we interviewed him, Dave, over a decade ago.
Still at Princeton. I think he's still alive. Last time I checked, he was. I don't think he's doing interviews anymore. But the Middle East, A Brief History of the Last 2,000 Years by Bernard Lewis. And guess what I have? I have Jim Grant's Marginalia. So he's interested in understanding why the Assassins were a Shia cult that terrorized the Sunnis. And this is, part of
the
book.
And that's what he hand wrote in the book. I'm looking at it right now.
Of course.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating look, not only into the history of the Middle East through the eyes of Bernard Lewis, but then also through the mind of a man that I have great respect for.
Right. And he's asking the questions. You get to see the questions as he's an inquiring mind. I've often said to be interesting, you have to be interested. And the people that we interview, these books, the marginalia, it's interesting. Oftentimes, it's not the information in a book that's important. It's the thought that goes behind it and the linkages that take you back into history. Yeah, I think right now of the tragedy that happened at Notre Dame in France. It's really not the building. We've both been to the building, okay? The building's an old building, but it's everything that's happened in and around that building for 800 years.
Well, exactly. I mean, a building that endured through multiple world wars, revolutions. A few weeks ago, we talked about the currency collapse, 1720s, and then 70 years later, again. And here in a 2.5 hour period, something that stood from the 12th century burns. And not completely to the ground, fortunately, but a good part of it did. And I watched the Notre Dame Tower fall in disbelief.
You know, you trained at Morgan Stanley in New York when the World Trade Centers were standing. You also watched what was at the South Building fall along with the other building. What did that feel like?
Yeah, the same thing, in disbelief. I was there at Morgan Stanley, and having been there, I think it's natural to feel a sense of solidarity with
right.
the French.
Right.
I have to tell you, this was an emotional experience watching Notre Dame Cathedral. And again, not just because I've been a tourist there, but because this is meaningful to the French, and I know that it's something that represents identity.
Do you remember the feeling when we watched the World Trade Center fall? Of disbelief. We had both been there, and it just didn't seem real. When you saw them collapsing, it didn't seem real. And you had brought up a book to me last night when we were talking about the Titanic. And that was the boat that was not supposed to sink either. People who were even on it didn't believe it could happen.
And that sense of disbelief, again, we look at these experiences through time, and the books that we read and the authors that we engage with and the marginalia we encounter, we're looking for wisdom and we're looking for common experience to better understand our own circumstances. And I think, you know, Sunday marked the 107th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, 1912, there on April 14th. And it took less than 2.5 hours to sink below the water. It had been described as a boat that not even God could sink.
Right.
It was a mark of progress. It was a mark of industrialization. And it was something that was great pride taking.
That was on a Sunday. 1,600 people never made the Monday.
Monday never came
yeah.
for those 1,600
yeah.
people. And, you know, it was in a ratio of 9 to 1. Men died and let the women and children go first. There were women who died too, and many valiantly who sacrificed their lives. What are, from our perspective, remarkably chivalrous choices were expected actions of a gentleman in those days.
And even the rich. Some of the richest men on earth died on that ship.
I think death is nature's form of affirmative action. You know, you look at the Astors and the Guggenheims and the wealthy travelers who perished alongside men of little to no means, and it's not really discriminating at all. Everybody pays a price when tragedy occurs.
Isn't it strange that Notre Dame, something that you would never think would just disappear like that, and it didn't disappear, but it burned, much of it burned, that was on the same week as the anniversary of the Titanic.
Well, and it's interesting because the events of this week and those of 107 years ago, they both create this initial sense of disbelief.
Yeah.
I could just as easily have thought that a doctored videotape was being aired. And I definitely asked myself the question if the Yellow Vests could have been that stupid
yeah.
to have jeopardized all that they were fighting for in Europe and particularly in France with a move like arson or something like that.
Isn't that amazing? That's where our mind goes because that's the culture that we're in right now. But, you know, take 100 years ago when the Titanic sank. This was a boat that had, for the first time, swimming pools on it, tennis courts. This was the lap of luxury, and only the richest could actually cross, at least on the upper cabins.
Yeah, what we have today makes this seem almost trivial, right? Because if you know, for $299, you can go on a 5-day cruise through the Caribbean.
Right.
We don't think about having, we think, well, you got to have multiple pools. You got to have, you know, how many things? But at 11:40 p.m., the boat grazed an iceberg. And it was on the starboard bow, and the impact was 947,000 tons of pressure.
And
they're cruising along at 21 knots and still below the full capacity of the ship. They could have actually traveled faster. And the Titanic was heading west at a very high latitude, and the effort was to shave 3 hours off the travel time and potentially set a new travel record. Minutes before the impact from the crow's nest, you have a call down to the bridge because the iceberg was sighted. and no one answered.
Yeah.
And then you had frantic attempts over that 2 to 3 minute period of warnings that someone has to respond, and there was no response. It went unheeded for 2 to 3 minutes.
Well, they felt the impact. I mean, the passengers said, yeah, we felt an impact, but they just ignored it. I mean, they were on the ship that couldn't sink. They weren't worried.
And finally, the phone was picked up, but there was no time to respond. The gentleman who answered the phone on the bridge, he shortly thereafter committed suicide. He knew that the cause was not picking up the phone. I don't know what he was doing in that 2 to 3 minutes, but he was not on his post. So the passengers felt the impact, but they didn't think anything of it. Many of them returned to bed. Others returned to playing cards, smoking cigars in the parlor. And, you know, some of the sirens, as they began to wail, you know, when you're on a boat, you hear horns whistle and you hear different things go off, and you just kind of think, well, something's going on, but it doesn't have anything to do with me.
Right.
So the passengers disregarded the crisis. And a part of it was because they had faith in engineering, and that blocked their imagination from running the full spectrum of potential outcomes.
It was outside of their paradigm. The thought of sinking, you've got a boat with a swimming pool, Dave, that cannot be sunk.
So you had jokes that were being exchanged. Then you had the crew encouraging people to put on life vests. But the travelers were joking about it, taking them on and off and saying, well, this color, of course, is the latest fashion this season. I mean, they have no idea. They weren't seriously considering that within minutes, everyone would be making decisions of life and death. And, you know, the captain asked for a report on the hull. The first report came back. There was no trace of damage to the hull. And obviously, they didn't look very closely.
That was the wrong first report.
But again, you have these things where confidence is there, and confidence is based on facts. 3 million rivets, the rivets alone weighing 1,200 tons. And then an additional 500,000 rivets, almost 270 tons of rivets holding together the double hull on the underbelly, right? So it's unthinkable that a boat like this could have problems. So, I mean, even on a first look appraisal, now there's nothing wrong.
Right.
Progressively, ship designs had been improved since the 1860s. And if you look at the laundry list of ships that sank between, say, 1866 and 1912, you'd be shocked at how many actually went under and how many lives were lost in transatlantic travel.
But not this one. It had a swimming pool. Tennis courts. Why?
Right. Every lesson had gone into this. This was the most progressive, the most luxurious, the most stable ship to ever sail. And it had everything. You're right. From swimming pools to tennis courts to gymnasiums, they had a grill room, a palm room, they had elevators. And again, for us, it's no big deal, but these were all stunning luxuries of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a notable deficiency. And we know that because we have our own luxury of looking back in time and appraising this, but there weren't enough lifeboats.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? That's the one thing they didn't have enough of. They had pianos. Okay. They had, like you said, tennis courts. They had grills. They had everything a person would need for luxury, but they didn't really think that anything bad could happen. I mean, this was a controlled environment. Gosh, does that sound familiar?
Two different life rafts were available, 24-footers, 36-footers. The cost of them was between $200 and $400. And these were line items that literally went ignored. They were building a $10 million colossus. Now, 1912 to the present, cumulative inflation from then to now is about 2,600%. So, you know, do the math, a $10 million boat then, still expensive today. But the point is, who needs a lifeboat when the ship is unsinkable? That's the presumption. That's the belief. That's where faith is. And their belief was it's unsinkable even by God.
Right.
That's the feeling today
that's
that
the
we
arrogance.
Have in the financial markets.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's a faith which has shifted to the financial engineers of our day because we know that nature has been tamed. The cycles are a thing of the past. The PhD is three letters with more power than G-O-D or any natural cycle. Does that make sense?
I mean, now, well, you know what Howard told me, the person you were talking about who sends us books now. You know, he's in his 90s. He studied economics all of his life. He was a lobbyist, you know, in politics. I asked him before I got off the phone the other day, I said, Howard, are there any words of wisdom you want to leave me with? And he says, yes, the cycle is still intact. That was all he said.
The cycle is still intact. Well, I mean, again, to founder, if you were on this ship, if you are in the financial markets today, to founder is unthinkable. And if you want to discuss it, it's disagreeable. Right. I mean, nobody wants to have that
conversation. Oh, you're so yesterday. You're talking about a possible crash? That's so yesterday.
Right. Well, to discuss it this week, Thursday, Doug Noland and I are going to conduct the quarterly conference call for our tactical short offering. So Q1 was the best stock market performance in a single quarter going back many decades. And Doug proved his value yet again in mitigating risk. Yes, maintaining a short exposure, but mitigating risk, maintaining the short exposure with the least possible impairment. And as a note, our other wealth management products will have a similar quarterly conference call starting at the end of Q2. Very constructive movement is being made across the MAPS offerings here in Q2, and I'm excited to talk about that a little bit more in the weeks and months ahead. So tactical short register, listen to it. Doug and I will share some analysis of the current market backdrop, and I think it'll confirm more than a few of your suspicions. 4 o'clock. PM Eastern Time, Thursday, you need to pre-register, and you can register at mwealthm.com.
mwealthm.com. Well, you talk about the quarter, this last quarter in the stock market being one of the best rising quarters in a long time. A short fund normally would get crushed in a period of time like that. And so we have to talk about these strategies. You know, when a person says, well, you know, I think we're getting toward the end of a cycle, I think I'm just going to go ahead and short the market. Well, that's been the doom of many a person.
Okay. Right, because crazy things happen at the end of a cycle. Right. And if you're not mitigating risk, and this is where the tactical short really has its distinction, because anyone who was short the market in a fund that doesn't modulate or moderate exposure, in the first quarter, they were crucified.
Right.
Most of them performed worse than the inverse of the market. So greater than 100% loss relative to the market. So if the Dow's up 13%, the S&P's up 16%, you might say, well, the inverse of that would be to lose 13 or 16. Oh, no, 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 no. Most of those short products lost far more than that. And so, again, this is where the distinction with tactical short comes through loud and clear. You can mitigate risk. You can have a short exposure and still be very intelligently managing your risk exposure on the upside.
As you've brought up, rising prices don't always tell the whole story. Okay. We've had rising prices this quarter, but we've actually had falling volume.
That's where some of the internals of the market really tell more of the story. And that has been the trend, rising prices on falling volumes. That's been the trend in the stock market since December. Even with healthy price action, there is that unhealthy, for lack of a better word, participation trend.
Well, can you manipulate a market easier if you have less participants?
I think that's one of the things that you gain with a thinning of the audience. The other is that you ultimately run out of buyers and you have a correction that sets in. So the move off the December lows, it feels good. But bear this in mind. Alan Newman, a frequent guest on our program, has often pointed this out, that flows into the equity market fall off hard after April, and they're typically dead through October. So this dead season from, say, May to October, this is a seasonal period that's unfriendly to investors.
That's the old saying, sell in May.
And go away. So mutual funds see a surge in new funds in the first quarter, typically because of an influx from retirement account contributions. Mm-hmm. So that follows, you know, again, you've got the April cutoff for those contributions, and thereafter it gets rough. Sell in May. It's not a perfect strategy, but it serves as a reminder that there is a season when the winds change and are no longer behind you. They're no longer helping put wind in the sails.
Well, I'm talking about so yesterday. I mean, mutual funds were the big deal, you know, 20 years ago. But at this point, ETFs have just sort of dwarfed the mutual fund market.
Well, at least in terms of growth. If you're looking at total assets under management, mutual funds are still the behemoth. But the migration has occurred. And the transformation of the markets where mutual fund flows, they now tell only part of the story. It's still an important part of the story. They're still an important player, but the ETF flows have captured capital in the last decade or so that used to be in mutual funds. So several things I think are important here. First is that there are far more ETFs, exchange-traded funds, funds to represent a low-cost basket of stocks than there are publicly traded stocks.
Now, say that again, because that's interesting. The funds that actually hold the baskets of stocks,
there's more
of those than there are stocks to hold.
That's right. There's a greater number of baskets than there is stocks to actually hold. It's a little absurd, but the derivations of market exposure using a structured and fee-collecting product exceed all the pure exposures to the underlying companies. So on top of that, I think another important piece with the ETFs is that the capitalization weighted indexes, they create this self-reinforcing, let's call it a popularity spiral. It's disconnected from company fundamentals.
That's so, like what the FANGs did last year, where the FANG stocks, five or six stocks, were leading everybody, but it was their capitalization that got those ETFs to buy them.
If you're buying the quote-unquote market, then there's a disproportionate number of dollars that go to those that have the largest total value or stock capitalization. So, for instance, Netflix gets a larger continual flow of money from the index ETFs than a pharmaceutical giant like Eli Lilly. Newman points out, Alan Newman again, that Eli Lilly is far larger in terms of revenues, in terms of profits, in terms of the number of employees, but any new money that comes into the S&P 500 index, that is SPY, it goes in larger quantities, larger sums of money to Netflix, because again, it's a cap-weighted or capitalization-weighted index.
Even though Netflix isn't making any money, they're just taking in investor money.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I think the last thing to be said there is that the market reflected by mutual funds used to maintain a managed feel or a managed orientation that allowed for cyclical decisions to be made where you could increase cash and decrease asset exposure. There's some discretion there, right?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, one of the big differences between mutual funds and ETFs, I remember when mutual fund cash would drop below 5, people would start saying, uh-oh, they're going to have to sell.
Cycle.
Yeah, because they're going to have to sell stock to actually take in redemptions. But ETFs, they don't have any cash, do they?
Right. So the migration away from mutual funds takes out some of the cushion in the marketplace provided by the cash component in those funds. Because if someone starts to sell, the first thing that they can get in terms of a redemption is the cash portion that's already sitting there.
It's like reserve banking.
And it doesn't require that the asset has to be liquidated. So there's not a negative reinforcing cycle on the sell side. But with ETFs, there is that negative reinforcing sell because it's an instantaneous, if you're redeeming money from an ETF, you instantly have to sell the product. That cushion goes away. And I've shared anecdotes about friends of mine in the mutual fund management role, but there is a trend within the mutual fund industry that pressure is being created on fund managers to diminish their cash holdings. You might say, why? Why would that be the case? Mutual fund companies now view cash as a four-letter word because any allocation to cash in this cycle has meant that you're underperforming the indexes. You're underperforming an exchange-traded fund, and you may face an existential threat where money leaves you and goes to a low-cost index.
Well, the stock market at this point is the ship that God can't sink. That's what you're saying.
That's right. Yeah. So there is this all-in approach. You mentioned cash levels getting below 5% and that being a warning sign. We're at 3%. 3% wow. Allocated to cash at present, buttressed by $581 billion in margin balances.
That's just pure debt. Margin balances.
If you're looking at RIDEX assets, comparing bearish versus bullish bets, a 26-to-1 ratio of bullish assets compared to bearish allocations. I mean, in short, what Newman would describe this environment as is excessively optimistic. On a 10-point scale, you're at a 9. So it could be even more excessive. Theoretically, you've got one more notch. But he says this, we are not dealing with the possibility of a bear market. We are dealing with the possibility of the major averages eventually losing 45 to 50%. And he maintains his long-term Dow target of around 15,000.
Okay, so we could lose that amount. Now, you were in New York last week with Russell Napier, who wrote the book Anatomy of the Bear. We bring it up often on the program. He's feeling the same way. The capital flows, where they're going right now, has to do with capitalization. Discretion's not really being used as to what's a good investment. It's just, where's all the money?
Right. And he would describe that passive movement of funds without a lot of analysis as sort of dumb and dumber.
Okay.
So he's making a similar point, Napier does, relating to ETFs and specifically tying it to the Chinese market in anticipated capital flows. You've got foreign capital flows into China, which are expected to rise in the coming months. And again, he puts that in the category of dumb and dumber because he's looking at two particular funds, the MSCI Equity Index and Bloomberg Barclays Bond Index, which are becoming more expansive in their Chinese holdings. And it automatically brings capital, foreign direct investment into China.
Let me understand. This indexing isn't just a national phenomenon here. These are world indexes. We're seeing indexes going, this is affecting the world. China is changing dramatically anyway, just for the fact that they're no longer a surplus nation. Well, we've counted on that surplus for a long time here in the United States to be able to go into debt.
And I think the reason why Napier cares about what's happening in terms of capital flows is because of this issue you raise. We have the surplus days, that is Chinese trade surplus days with the United States behind us. Mm-hmm. The current account surplus is shifting to a deficit, which is a monumental shift. And we've talked about that countless times on our program, but it implies that there's a much smaller pool of capital to recycle into U.S. treasuries. And those trade dollars that have been recycled into U.S. treasuries, they help finance our budget deficit. Right? So now you have investors who will go into the Chinese markets, not with a thoughtful appraisal of risk and reward or the credit quality of a particular company or of a particular bond, but because you get an increase in Chinese exposure in two indexes, the MSCI Equity Index and the Bloomberg Barclays Bond Index. And again, Napier refers to them quasi-respectfully as dumb and dumber money flowing in, not because they're attractive assets.
Right. It's because everybody else is going in.
Exactly. Exactly. I love the irony here because you have the contrast of local investors, local money, Chinese capital that is trying to get out of the country. And, you know, in the last decade, they've sought to evade and escape the borders mm-hmm. with mass quantities of liquidity. So foreign capital flows will increase because of a composition adjustment in the indexes. This is foreign money coming in while domestic money is getting out. And again, it's ironic because we think there's an opportunity, but the smartest money has already left the room, has already left the country.
Well, those who live in the room, those who live in China want their money out because they're seeing increasing control from the government. They've seen this before. I mean, it was sort of free markety. Now we're seeing command and control.
That's right. And Napier's primary point here is that when you have a decline in the rule of law and an increase in the rule of man, as you've had under Xi Jinping, watching domestic investor behavior is telling. Ignoring it looks like the dumb and dumber money which is flowing in. So the problem is that those sources of capital that are flowing in to China, they're not likely to be sufficient to improve the capital account. So the capital account is just a measure of capital flowing into or out of a country and is a part of the larger balance of payments equation. Okay, so that's just for context. Recall that for 20 years, capital has flowed out of China and into the U.S. Treasury market, into the GSE market, that is government-sponsored entities like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and a host of other U.S. dollar-denominated assets. Those flows have been critical to asset price appreciation. They've improved the value of the U.S. dollar. And what we have circa 2018-2019 is a shift in capital flows, which is very consequential if you're looking at the decades ahead.
So look at the decades behind us. Okay, the last three, maybe four decades, what we've counted on is Chinese pegging their own currency to the dollar and treating the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Now, what we've seen over the last 6-7 years is China just aggressively consuming and buying all the gold, virtually all of it. I mean, 22,000-24,000 tons maybe, which is three times what they say is in Fort Knox. That's not to speculate on the gold market, Dave. They're looking at a currency shift. They're looking possibly at the U.S. dollar not looking like it did back during the Bretton Woods days or even the post-Bretton Woods days.
It's funny because Russell and I exchanged some emails before we got to New York, and I sat with him in New York City last week, and we spoke briefly before he presented to the audience and then sort of hastily returned to Toronto for the course he's instructing. But in our email conversations, he's very interested in the direction of gold and convinced that what will happen in the currency markets will define the gold market for the next 20 to 25 years. Hmm. And I heard in his voice maybe even a small bit of envy that we are in the business that we're in, knowing what we're getting ready to experience on a global scale and what the supply and demand dynamics are for an asset that is very scarce.
So, Dave, the company is 48 years old. If there is a shift, we are in the catbird seat.
I know. And it's his view that we're on the edge of a shift in the currency markets as critical as the 1971 and 72 Bretton Woods period. So from 1994 to the present, the renminbi, the RMB, has been pegged to the dollar. It's a loose peg. And he sees a growing probability of an RMB floating exchange rate. So again, the surplus days are over. Trade surplus days are over.
Right.
Money supply growth is likely to decline in China, requiring greater capital inflows into China. And here are the factors, because money supply growth was averaging 16 to 17%. We look at where it is today, and it's still eye-popping in the 8, 8.5% range, but it's already dropped by half, right? So foreign currency reserves, they grew dramatically in the era of trade dollar recycling when they were running massive trade surpluses. They're now shrinking. Compare that with the TIC data we have from the Treasury Department here in the United States, and it shows U.S. savers are being forced to step into the Treasury market. They're the ones who are doing some of the buying, even as the Chinese move to liquidate exposure, and other central bankers too, eliminate exposure to U.S. Treasuries at the margins, not completely. His suggestion is that pressure will grow, and the greatest financial market shift of our generation will be the flotation of the RMB. In his words, it changes everything for the next 25 years.
Yeah, so the flotation of the RMB is just simply the dollar no longer is the peg. The dollar may not even be the reserve currency as China flows forward.
Well, it also brings in another interesting element, that of the export of inflation from the Chinese, where all of a sudden the inflationary trends, which we have not been able to conjure, central banks have been worried about the deflationary trends, in fact, could sharply shift and very quickly. So the conclusion is that we've thought of Chinese exports representing kind of the price dampening element for the U.S. and global consumer. You buy stuff, you buy it cheap, you buy it at Walmart, you buy it at Amazon, you buy it cheap because it's manufactured in a place that they can make it for next to nothing. What if the Chinese became a significant contributor to global consumer price inflation instead of a contributor, as they have been for 30 years, to that price deflationary trend?
One of the ways we fought war without tanks and guns and ships is just simply competitive devaluation worldwide. I'm wondering if the capital flows aren't also going to possibly be a form of financial war that's a non-shooting war.
That's the front line of the war. It's not a trade war. I mean, what we see happening between us and the Chinese right now, if you think this is about trade, you don't understand the real issue here, because there you're only talking about the flows of tens or hundreds of billions of dollars. You know, you cap it at $250 billion and the ancillary effects of $250 billion churning around in the global economy. Who cares? When you're talking about the FX markets, you're talking about trillions of dollars changing hands on a daily basis.
That's the bigger war.
Napier suggests that capital flows are on the front line of a war. It's not a trade war, but it's the beginning of a 21st century Cold War with China. And he points to Mike Pence, who gave a speech at the Hudson Institute last fall in October, supporting this stance, where Mike made it very clear what the issues were and what the current agenda was, according to the current White House, Noel Office.
So you think he's thinking that we will see competitive devaluation and it'll start in China?
Devaluation in China is an increasing probability. You know, if, like we talked about last week, you've got the modern so-called monetary theory and nominal GDP targeting around the corner here in the United States. Inherently inflationary. So if you look at it and say devaluation in China, growing probability, devaluation here domestically as well, on top of what the Fed is considering now, they're already talking about further unconventional approaches to stimulating inflation. Wouldn't it be ironic that we are, even as the Fed and other central bankers are doing everything that they can to create inflation, we're on the monetary cusp event, which reshapes the way we look at money and banking for a generation or more, and they're actually trying to stoke it.
Well, let's look at the tools that central banks use. We've talked about repression, purposely keeping interest rates artificially low, and inflation. Really, the goal is to borrow a certain amount and then to inflate the dollar just a little bit more than that, so that that debt gets ultimately paid off with the devaluation of the dollar. It's a dirty little secret, but that's exactly what's been happening all of our adult lives.
Yeah, as long as you can maintain growth in the economy above the growth in debt, they're not concerned. So the other issue is we are intent on inflating away those debts.
Right.
So, you know, further corralling of capital, that's a given. That's a given. If you look back at our conversation with Carmen Reinhart, it was absolutely an intellectual touchstone. For those of you who have not listened to it, go back to the archives. It's required listening because repression and inflation are the 1-2 punch of the central banking community. Mm-hmm. And individual investors are going to have to determine how they legally sidestep those swings. Because if they don't, they're going to get clocked in the financial face.
We've talked for a long time that you want to have a third in physical gold and silver, things that will keep you from losing money during the devaluation. But even the cash portion that you would normally leave in greenbacks, can be put into a cash equivalent. You've brought out Vaulted here recently, Dave, which is a cash equivalent based in gold.
Right. So Vaulted has become that for me, money and banking alternative, where you're talking about historical reliability and combining that with 21st century transparency and accessibility for savings and banking alternative. I don't look at it as gold. It just happens to be savings, reliable savings, denominated in a currency that I have more confidence in.
Right.
And I don't have as much confidence in the PhD we were talking about a few minutes ago. Institutional managers of money, get this, institutional managers of money and the entire central bank community are of one mind, and that is that it is impossible to create inflation.
It's the boat
today
that God cannot sink. But let's be fair. They have created trillions and trillions of dollars, and we haven't really experienced high or hyperinflation at this point.
Yeah, and my view definitely differs from the institutional money managers of the day and certainly the central bank community, because inflation has been created. It's already been created, but not unleashed. There's a variety of things that could instantly unleash that inflation. We just mentioned a structural change in the Chinese system. Instant. A reversal of the payments on excess reserves. This is a standard policy today that's never been done before. You have reserves that are held with our central bank that would ordinarily be lent into the system, and there would be a money multiplier on those assets. We haven't seen that because those reserves are being paid. The excess reserves of financial institutions are being warehoused with the Fed, and they're receiving interest on those deposits. There's no reason for them to lend it out. So the liquidity's there. That's what I'm saying. It's already there. It's been created. It has not been unleashed.
Don't we see that the Fed's in a corner, though? Okay, because they've been talking about normalizing interest rates. But didn't we see in the fourth quarter of 2018... didn't we see that they learned a lesson? We really can't push those rates up past 3%, can we?
No, we can't. And I mean, again, this goes back to that issue of now you don't see it, now you see it. What you cannot see today, inflation, is something that can be very pervasive tomorrow, literally with the stroke of a pen. That's all that stands between viable savings and a massive competitive devaluation, global in scale, is the stroke of a pen. We're not paying interest on excess reserves anymore. Stroke of a pen. We're letting the RMB float. Stroke of a pen. The stroke of a pen unleashes inflation. You think it's the printing presses. No, the credit machinery has already been cranking out more liquidity than the world knows what to do with.
But if the velocity of that cash increases, we could have inflation very quickly. And going back to the Fed not being able to raise rates, how do you fight inflation? You raise rates.
Well, so on the program here in the next few months, we're going to have Steve Henke. He is the expert on hyperinflation. I cornered him after his presentation at Grant's conference, and we debated velocity. And it was a great conversation. We're going to open up that conversation on the airwaves as he comes to be a guest on the commentary. But again, he doesn't think velocity is an issue. Of course, he's only interested in hyperinflations, not low levels of inflation, high inflation or superinflation. And by the way, this is the guy who came in to solve the Bulgarian hyperinflation, the Romanian hyperinflation. He's been a consultant on the Venezuelan issue right now.
So he knows a little something about high-speed velocity changing to the point where you don't call it velocity anymore. You just call it a collapse.
You just call it a currency collapse because velocity is not worth measuring. It's just like, yeah, that's an issue when people don't want it.
We want it. Now we don't.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I'm quibbling with him about the psychological transition point, and he's like, yeah, but it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, people get hungry in about 3 days.
Well, but your point earlier, this is really important because the Fed proved a very critical issue in 2018. The debt's outstanding. Copious amounts of debt on the world scene today. The debtors responsible to pay them. These two categories, they can't suffer a rise in rates above 3%.
That's a small box.
There's a low tolerance threshold for rising rates. There is a no tolerance policy among central bankers for allowing assets to be repriced to a new cost of capital. That's really the issue, is that when you have a repricing of assets in light of the increasing cost of capital, you're dealing with extinction events for a number of financial firms. Leverage is very high in the financial system. The amount of debt in the system, very high. When you begin to adjust asset prices, even marginally, in a leveraged universe, you're looking at major, major issues. So, going back to Reinhardt, the chosen losers in this scenario, we already see it, the chosen losers of the world today are the savers, the people who need income.
Right. The retired, the savers.
Savers in recent years have given up hundreds of billions of annual income, which has instead acted as a subsidy for two over-leveraged segments, the corporate sector and the government sectors. Do you think that's going to change? Think again. So you've got repression and you've got inflation, and this is the 1-2 punch. You better get used to it.
I've got a question for you, though, because you manage money. How do you manage money to keep up with the indexes and to try to give people what they believe that they are entitled to in the rising markets, and still not be invested in a place where they lose their shirts with the sinking of the Titanic?
Yeah. Well, as an asset manager, the challenge set before me for 2019 and 2020 is how to marry a portfolio of real assets. So with inflation protection implicit to the asset themselves, with real-time income generation. So I'm excited to be announcing a few things here in the second quarter that I think will fill a void. It's a void in the marketplace that's growing as the 1-2 punch I described a minute ago is on full display and is only going to intensify over the next few years.
Back when I was in high school, just coming out of high school, a man named Paul Volcker came along, and he had to deal with inflation. We were going out of control. No, these were the late Carter years, early Reagan years. So Paul Volcker just yanked the interest rates right up to what he felt they needed to be to break that inflation. Do we have a system that could work in?
Oh, well, Napier was interesting. He just finished Volcker's book, and kind of, I've learned some things from Volcker's book previous to this about his stance on gold and how he would have treated the gold market differently if he had it to do over again.
He would have manipulated it if he had it to do over again.
Volcker, in his memoir, describes the current monetary system as a non-system, as a non-system. And I think that's honest. I think that's accurate. Post-Bretton Woods, an entirely floating currency system. What kind of a system is it? It's a free-for-all. You can get away with murder from the standpoint of printing, creating unlimited amounts of currency and credit. That is the system in which faith and confidence has been placed.
Right.
I consider it non-system. Nevertheless, it's a system in which faith and confidence have been placed.
Enough so that you don't have to have enough lifeboats.
It's assumed to be stable.
Yeah.
It's assumed to be well engineered. It's assumed to be enduring. And it's assumed that we can use the system that we have, the monetary system that we have, to travel faster and in greater luxury than ever before. The monetary system of our day is a system that not even God can sink, or so it's believed. There's nothing new under the sun. I think this is where we circle back around to what we learn from history and the things that, even though the machinery and technology may change, people don't. People don't. There's nothing new under the sun. We will always be at our greatest degree of risk and peril when feelings of confidence and poise are the greatest. Take an assessment of your life. You'll find that to be true. Take an assessment of the financial markets. You'll find that to be true. You'll find that to be true of great leaders. And even the old poem by Percy Bysshe Shelley, Ozymandias of Egypt, points that out. I met a traveler from an antique land. This is someone who goes through the Middle East and says, I found these stumps of a statue. Just the ankles were left. And on this placard next to the stumps, it says, look at my greatness and despair. And he looks around at the vastness of the empty desert and realizes that all that was once great is gone. It's gone. Hubris is the element which builds. Hubris is the element which builds the most majestic monuments. But it's also the preceding ingredient for the memorials which mark the wreckage left throughout history.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. And you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.